From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We're past the point where you can comfortably ignore the presidential election. In Iowa, early voting has already begun, and in Ohio, it starts Tuesday. On Wednesday in Denver, we have the first debate between the two nominees. And as usual, the campaigns are trying to tamp down our expectations by talking up the rhetorical skills of the opposing candidate. On Air Force One, Obama's traveling press secretary Jen Psaki called Mitt Romney the most prepared presidential debater in modern history, whereas her candidate, she said, hadn't really had time to study. As for Romney, when asked on a tarmac in Dayton whether voters are expecting too much of him on debate night, he conceded sensibly,
"I don't know exactly how to raise or lower expectations,"
and then immediately reminded viewers that
"the president is obviously a very eloquent, gifted speaker. He'll do just fine."
Also keeping our expectations modestly in check, the debate moderators, PBS's Jim Lehrer for the 12th time, CBS veteran Bob Schieffer, ABC's Martha Raddatz for the vice presidential debate, and CNN's Candy Crowley, who will host a town hall-style event with the two presidential candidates. Lacking a Fox News presence, to some critics, the lineup is, you know, lamestream. Here's Rush Limbaugh on Lehrer.
Far left-wing liberal Democrat.
Schieffer.
Far, far left-wing liberal Democrat. And dinosaur.
Raddatz.
Far, far left-wing liberal Democrat.
And Crowley.
Far, far left-wing Democrat mama.
Another fun fact about the moderators, no woman has moderated a debate between two presidential candidates for 20 years. The first and last woman to do so was former ABC correspondent and news anchor Carol Simpson back in 1992, who had the rare distinction of wrangling three candidates.
The candidates are the Republican nominee, President George Bush, the independent, Ross Perot, and Governor Bill Clinton, the Democratic nominee.
Last August, three teenage girls from Montclair, New Jersey, petitioned for more women moderators, and they gathered some 180,000 names. We don't know if that influenced the choice of the Commission on Presidential Debates. We do know that in the Simpsons' view, the role of the female journalist in the current debate lineup shows that very little has changed.
The men are going to be able to go head-to-head with the candidates. I just found out that Jim Lehrer is going to devote half of the 90 minutes to the economy. Then we've got Bob Schieffer, and he's going to be doing international affairs for the last debate. In between that is Candy Crowley. She will be doing what I did, be the lady with the microphone among an audience of undecided voters. I didn't have any opportunity to ask my own questions of the candidates. Now Candy, who is one of the most politically astute reporters in the country, has got the same town hall format. It looks like the commission is deciding that the town hall format is what women should do, and the real tough questioning should come from men. Martha Raddatz at ABC is a fantastic journalist, and she has been chosen to moderate the vice presidential debate. Two other debates have been moderated by a woman, both of them by Gwen Ifill from PBS, and she did a fine job. It looks like it's a woman slot now, and it's not the really big show. I think it's outrageous.
What is it specifically you think is going to be missing if you don't have experienced women asking some questions of their own?
I have great respect for Jim Lehrer and for Bob Schieffer, and I'm sure they could ask questions about reproductive rights, which have become issues in this campaign. But they're not going to ask them with the authority and the import that a woman would.
Do you mean that they're better equipped to follow up and not accept an insufficient response?
Absolutely, because they know and they care. Women vote in greater numbers and are the majority of the population, And I just think it's important that women ask questions that women want answers to. I mean, I can't believe that Lair has decided that he's going to do 3 of his 6 segments on the economy when there are so many other issues.
So what do you think Crowley should do?
Well, if Candy is stuck in that town hall format and there hasn't been a voter who has asked a question about women's rights, I think I would break the rules and just ask the question. It's just got to be dealt with.
So you're saying she should go rogue?
I would go rogue.
Carol, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Former ABC News anchor Carol Simpson is the author of News Lady. Also, thanks to the Paley Center for helping put us together.
Last year, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jose Antonio Vargas wrote an essay in the New York Times called My Life as an Undocumented Immigrant, detailing the years he'd hidden his immigration status from his employers, friends, and just about everyone else in his life. In the years since, Vargas founded a project called Define American, meant to foster discussion about immigration issues. Last week, Vargas announced a new facet of the Define American project, an initiative to track and influence news organizations that use the term illegal alien or illegal immigrant, as opposed to his preferred phrasing, undocumented immigrant.
My beef, such as it is, with the term illegal immigrant and illegal alien is the fact that they're inaccurate and imprecise. To be in this country without papers is actually a civil offense, not a criminal one. A Republican strategist named Frank Luntz back in 2005 actually wrote a memo specifically saying that people like me should be called illegal aliens and illegal immigrants to further criminalize people like me. So how can journalists who are supposed to be neutral take something off the pages of somebody like Frank Luntz? The other question here is about 50% of the people who are in America, quote unquote, illegally, came to America legally. They overstayed their visa. And so saying that everybody's, quote unquote, illegal actually doesn't acknowledge the complexity of the immigration system.
Obviously, language can be loaded. Frank Luntz, the Republican strategist you described, has made a living exploiting loaded terms. But it's also true that the effort to destigmatize via wordplay, it's a sort of a slippery slope away from the very precision you're talking about, right? I mean, there was a time we called people who were developmentally disabled retarded, but that became stigmatized. And, you know, then they were mentally handicapped. But, oh, no, it's not a handicap. Then they were differently abled. And at some point, you lose any idea of what we're actually talking about.
No? Well, I mean, again, we're not talking about wordplay. When I came out, so to speak, in the New York Times magazine last summer, I could have issued this challenge then. But frankly, I don't think culturally we were prepared. I think the biggest disruption in the immigrant rights movement in the past 2 to 3 years have been because of people who have, quote unquote, come out. And why are we coming out about our immigration status? To be seen as full human beings. The fact that the language is used as such, that I'm this illegal alien as if I just landed there from Mars, frames the conversation in already such this pejorative way. Can you think of any other instance that we refer to a group of people as illegal in this country? We don't call it illegal driving. We call it drunk driving, right?
But it's illegal parking, and you know, nobody has ever quibbled with that and suggested unstatutorial parking or something like that.
Actions are illegal, not people. Can you imagine, like, hearing this word illegal and knowing that it refers to you, what that does to somebody?
I understand, but I have to ask you this. I'm a big fan of calling things by their name, right?
Oh, yeah, of course.
And in this case, while it may not be criminal to be living here outside the law, it is nonetheless against the law. It's still illegal. But really, I think, Jose, the main question is, if you come up with another choice, isn't it inevitable that whatever term you embrace will itself, in time, become as loaded and pejorative as the word it replaced?
I was in Alabama last year for about a week. I'm actually going back again next month. And what I found really interesting was talking to people like outside of Walmart or something, and how people move from the illegals to Mexicans. a fluid transition from complaining about these illegal people that have taken over Birmingham to all of a sudden complaining about these Mexicans and overhearing Spanish at Walmart.
Aren't there bigger fish to fry here in societies dealing with immigration than word choice?
To me, questioning the use of the word illegal in referring to people opens up the conversation. I'm not what you think I am. We are not who you think we are. We're not the other people. We're actually one of you. That's why this is not just wordplay. This is actually at the heart of this conversation. What we're called and why we're called what we're called. We know how Washington thinks about this. We know that it's like a political hot potato. If newsrooms can't have this conversation, then we're not going to get anywhere with this issue.
Let's just say you're successful. Let's just say the AP style book and the New York Times decide that it is less stigmatizing and more accurate to say undocumented.
Or unauthorized, yeah.
Is it not inevitable that in a very short time, we're going to be having this conversation again, only this time you'll be trying to remove the word undocumented from the lexicon because it has taken on a stigma?
I see completely your question and this whole notion of this being a slippery slope. I'm sorry that I am almost myopic in my focus on this one word and this one term because I've grown up with it. And it comes with not only a personal baggage, but it comes with this kind of journalistic question of how can we be as accurate and as descriptive as possible? And I'm sorry to say this, as far as I'm concerned, illegal immigrant and illegal alien are neither of those things.
Jose, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jose Antonio Vargas is a journalist and founder of the Define American Project.
Coming up, how scientists manipulate the press. Studies show that 100% of the guests coming up on our show believe it's working all too well.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR. On the Media is supported by Audible.com, a provider of digital audiobooks and more, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. Audible's selection includes Isaac Asimov's The End of Eternity, Dean Kuntz's Audapocalypse, or any of the Dresden Files series by Jim Boother. To learn more about Audible and get a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/onthemedia.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last week, you may have come across some news reports about French scientists finding a link between genetically modified food and cancer. Their research was announced at a press conference on the very same day it was published in the journal Food and Chemical Toxicology. That's not unusual. What is unusual is that in order to get an early peek at the study, reporters had to sign a non-disclosure agreement that made it impossible for them to get other experts to weigh in on the research. This manipulative practice, says science writer Carl Zimmer, ensures that the scientists can, quote, bask in the badly reported media spotlight. He says that the French study, which involved feeding genetically modified corn to rats, was far from perfect.
So the control rats, 30% of the males and 20% of the females, developed tumors. The rats that got fed the genetically modified corn, 50% of the males developed cancer and 70% of the females developed cancer.
Well, that's a lot more cancer.
Sure, it sounds like a lot more.
It is a lot more, right?
Well, is it a lot more statistically speaking? Is it so much more that you can start to say definitively that genetically modified food causes cancer? And actually, you can't in this case. In fact, the paper does not actually show whether or not the cancer rates are statistically significant. That's something that you just expect to see in any paper like this.
The French study was published in a peer-reviewed journal. Doesn't that ensure that scientists who aren't affiliated with the study have already had a look at the research and deemed it credible?
Peer review is important, but it's no guarantee that the science is right. Science reporters need to talk to other scientists whenever they're reporting on research. And it's especially important when it's extremely controversial. We've had these huge debates about genetically modified food, screaming matches around the world. In California, actually, they're considering whether to label genetically modified foods. And the people who are advocating for that immediately grabbed onto this study. As soon as this study was in the press, the French prime minister said that if it was confirmed, that France would push to ban genetically modified corn in all of Europe. So you have to be able to check with other scientists, other experts, to see whether the science really holds up. And in this case, as soon as other scientists took a look at this paper, they said, whoa, this is a mess.
Why was it a mess?
The groups of rats that were being given different treatments were very small. There were only 10 rats in each group. The rats that they chose are a special breed of rats that's actually very prone to getting cancer. This is actually important for scientists who want to study cancer and how tumors develop. So these are an important breed of rats. The problem is that if you're only using these small groups of rats, you might just end up with one group of rats that have a lot of tumors just because that's how the rats are. This kind of study is often done with many more rats in each group, say like 50 or even 100. It's expensive, it's difficult, but if you want to get the statistics right, you need more rats.
What really set the fire under you is not that journalists were given this article in advance, but that they had to sign a confidentiality agreement. In other words, this was a rare example of not being able to do any advance reporting on a scientific study.
Right. The only advance reporting that people could do was just to listen to what the authors of the study told them. The paper was embargoed until the middle of a press conference where they were announcing the results. That way, they were ensuring lots and lots of coverage skewed their way. It would be sensationalized because there wouldn't be any way of talking to other scientists. There has been follow-up reporting that has focused on the controversy, but it's really important to make sure that the first reporting on something is done right, because a lot of times that's just what people look at.
And you suggest that journalists just walk away if asked to sign a confidentiality agreement.
Absolutely. This is wrong. I learned that the BBC had done exactly this. They had been offered the paper a day in advance if they signed this confidentiality agreement, and they just said, forget it, and they walked away.
But if you walk away, you also don't have any opportunity to offer scientific opinions because you don't have enough preparation time. You just miss the cycle.
Well, you're not going to be doing any legitimate reporting if you take that paper and can't talk to anybody else. What you're going to come out with is bad journalism. And what journalist wants to come out with bad journalism?
It's about the hits.
Well, I suppose that there are reporters out there who get pressure from their editors to cave in and just sign these things so that you can get the hits right away. But those aren't places worth working for.
Carl, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Carl Zimmer teaches science writing at Yale University and writes The Loom blog for DiscoverMagazine.com.
This week, jailed Russian punk band Pussy Riot was nominated for the European Parliament's prestigious Sakharov Prize.
The man behind the nomination, Green MEP Werner Schulz, said these young women have shone a light on and protested against an autocratic system with courage, creativity, and inner force. They have embarrassed a patriarchal power, and they have exposed judicial arbitrariness.
Also this week, Russia's lower house of parliament voted to drastically expand the definition of high treason, whereas before it was narrowly defined as assisting a foreign state in a way that jeopardizes Russia's external security, it now includes any acts against, quote, constitutional order, sovereignty, and territorial and state integrity. The change effectively makes activists and journalists who are critical of the government subject to the same harsh punishment formerly reserved for bona fide spies. Fred Weir of the Christian Science Monitor is a longtime Russia hand based in Moscow. He says many of these changes seem to flow from the president, Vladimir Putin.
Since he began his third term back in May, there has been a raft of new legislation that makes it harder to engage in any kind of public protest, harder to use the internet, harder to express yourself because of fear of the new defamation laws. Now, this new amendment, which will really extend the definition of treason, is really the scariest thing to happen yet. It's so vaguely worded that it's hard to know who it wouldn't apply to. Almost anyone who has dealings with foreigners now will have to think twice.
It sounds almost Soviet.
I was told today that the definitions in this law itself are from the Soviet criminal code. It was all abolished in the 1990s, and we got more of a modern, Western-like law on espionage and treason and so on. So this is a reversion.
What can talking to an American-funded NGO earn a Russian who defies the law?
12 to 20 years in a penal colony. And you can apparently land in that position by giving some sort of unspecified assistance or help, not only to a foreign government, but to a foreign organization. This is one of the changes in the law. This is really about intimidating everybody, making them afraid to go out to public meetings, making them afraid to give their name to a foreign journalist, restoring that old Soviet paradigm of fear.
Who do you think Putin is most interested in intimidating?
The authors of the NGO law that forces NGOs to self-identify as foreign agents told us, helpfully, which groups really angered them. And they were groups like Golos, a grassroots election monitoring organization that actually fielded 50,000 observers in the Duma elections last December and laid the basis for the protest movement, because they documented huge numbers of cases of ballot stuffing and other forms of election fraud. And so Golos definitely is a target. Transparency International, the Russian branch, which has done an awful lot of work in shaming corrupt officials, is another one. And the two human rights groups, Memorial and the Moscow Helsinki Group, are clearly in the sights as well. All of these organizations continue to receive a fair bit of foreign funding.
What about something like Radio Liberty, which is explicitly U.S. government funded? What's going on with them?
Radio Liberty announced last week that it's closing its bureau here in Moscow. It's firing a lot of people who are mainly Russians, and it will go into a multimedia but web-based mode of broadcasting in future. Amendments to the media law make it illegal for any broadcasting outfit that's more than half owned by foreigners to operate in Russia. USAID was kicked out last week.
Now, USAID, the Agency for International Development, is probably guilty of funding projects that have some sort of Western skew. But that doesn't make them spies.
This is true. USAID does a lot of works that probably didn't irritate the Russians, like medical aid, fighting human trafficking, helping the disabled. It did an awful lot of those kind of projects, but over a third of its funding went to human rights groups, organizations like Golos. Those are clearly the activities that led to USAID being kicked out.
At any point, will Putin pay a penalty domestically as screws get tightened further and further?
I lived and worked for 5 years in the Soviet Union, and that was a well-oiled police state that kept us journalists at arm's length from the population. And all that went away, more or less. 2 decades ago is a long time, and Russians are different now. And I do not see how that old paradigm can be restored.
You think there'll be a show trial early to just get the message across to the Russian people?
Pussy Riot itself was something of a show trial designed to chill the atmosphere. You can't just put everybody back into that box. They've been out of it for 2 decades. And so I can't predict when and where or what it will be, but examples will have to be made so that people get it through their heads that this is how things are now.
All right, Fred, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fred Weir is the Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor.
On the campus at Berkeley, there was beginning a phase of this youth revolt that was to be heard around the world.
The political tumult of the 1960s, when the remnants of the Red Scare collided with Vietnam protests and the student free speech movement, had its epicenter on the campus of the University of California at Berkeley.
And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Movement leaders such as 21-year-old Mario Savio, speaking here on the Berkeley campus in 1964, lit a fire under the FBI that raged for years. Student journalist Seth Rosenfeld got onto the story and spent decades investigating FBI misconduct in pursuing the student movement. And now, he has finally published Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. It documents the secret relationships between the FBI and Ronald Reagan, with hand-picked journalists and with the radical movement itself. The book is based on some 300,000 pages of FBI records obtained through five separate Freedom of Information Act requests. The FBI spent more than $1 million fighting the release of these records, but seven federal judges ruled in Rosenfeld's favor. Among the revelations therein, Ronald Reagan's long career as an FBI informant and collaborator, starting in the late 40s when he was president of the Screen Actors Guild.
Reagan continued as an informant through the 1950s. J. Edgar Hoover repaid the favor by giving Reagan personal and political help.
Such as intervention in family matters.
Yes. In 1959, Ronald Reagan and his former wife, Jane Wyman, became concerned about their eldest daughter, Maureen Reagan. She was 19 years old, and she had moved to Washington, D.C., and they had heard that she was living with an older married policeman. Instead of simply calling up their daughter and asking her what was going on, Ronald Reagan and Jane Wyman turned to the FBI. One FBI agent posed as an insurance salesman and interviewed neighbors of Maureen Reagan. Another interviewed the cleaning lady. J. Edgar Hoover personally authorized an FBI investigation into the romantic life of Maureen Reagan. When Ronald Reagan was elected governor in 1966, J. Edgar Hoover finally had an ally in the governor's mansion. A few weeks after Reagan took office, he phoned the FBI and requested a confidential briefing, not only about student activists, but also about university president Clark Kerr and liberal members of the Board of Regents. Hoover personally authorized this briefing. 2 weeks later, Clark Kerr was fired as president of the University of California. In the months and years following, J. Edgar Hoover continued to give Ronald Reagan confidential reports about student activists and professors. Reagan used this information to quash student protests and other First Amendment activity at the University of California.
At the same time, the FBI was using friendly press to undermine its perceived enemies.
One of the most prominent reporters in San Francisco was a man named Ed Montgomery. In 1951, Montgomery won the Pulitzer Prize for exposing corruption involving underworld figures and officials of the Bureau of Internal Revenue, as the IRS was then known. All along, he had a secret relationship with the FBI. Montgomery was a larger-than-life character. He had dark, swept-back hair, horn-rimmed eyeglasses. He wore a bulky hearing aid that he would, according to legend, sometimes lower through a heating duct so he could eavesdrop on conversations in other rooms. In the 60s, when student protests erupted at UC Berkeley, the FBI gave Montgomery information containing allegations that members of the free speech movement had connections to the Communist Party. This information was greatly distorted because the FBI had already investigated the free speech movement and knew that there was a tiny percentage of students who had some connection to the Communist Party or the Socialist Party. In fact, the free speech movement included students of all political persuasions, including young Republicans and young Democrats. But the FBI provided these allegations to Montgomery, and he ran a front-page series in the San Francisco Examiner, picked up widely around the country. In the following years, J. Edgar Hoover ordered other information leaked to Ed Montgomery to discredit the anti-war movement or to tarnish student activists or liberal professors who were involved in the anti-war movement.
And it wasn't just Ed Montgomery. There was a number of friendly journalists who Hoover could count on to embellish the communist threat narrative.
He had actually created a program called the Mass Media Program. And there were scores of reporters around the country, reporters, broadcasters, editors, who the FBI trusted to confidentially receive information and to report it without revealing the FBI's role in trying to influence public opinion. All this comes out in the FBI records that were released to me under the Freedom of Information Act.
as both a beneficiary of FOIA and its three decades long victim, what's your take on the state of the Freedom of Information Act in 2012?
During the course of my research, I had the opportunity to study FBI records that had been released under six presidential administrations. I can say that while Democratic administrations are somewhat friendlier to the Freedom of Information Act than Republican administrations, there's an enormous problem within the federal government of overclassifying documents. I was encouraged when President Obama, as one of his first acts in office, issued a strong statement in support of the Freedom of Information Act. But I soon came to realize that that memo apparently never reached the Justice Department. I want to note that today's FBI is very different than J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. There's much more public accountability. There's much more congressional oversight. Nonetheless, I would say the FBI is withholding as much information under the Freedom of Information Act today as it did under the administrations of George Bush.
Well, Seth, congratulations on the book. Now, I strongly advise you to go outside. Just, live a little.
Thank you so much.
Seth Rosenfeld is the author of Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power.
Coming up, what if you made a movie that opened nationwide and nobody came? Well, almost nobody.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org, and the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence, at thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's no big secret that consumers, when signing up for a service online, probably aren't reading everything they're supposedly agreeing to. And who can blame them? Earlier this year, the Daily Mail reported that PayPal's terms of service are longer than Shakespeare's Hamlet, and iTunes' agreement beats Macbeth. This bothers McKeel DeYoung, a self-described hacktivist and co-founder of the website TOSDR, short for Terms of Service Didn't Read. To illustrate just how willing people are to click on I Agree, McKeel recalls one prank from 2 years ago when the UK retailer GameStation got its users to sign away more than they'd bargained for.
As a joke, to prove that nobody actually was reading their terms of service, they put a clause in there somewhere in the middle saying, you sell your soul to them when you sign up for this service. They put this live on their website, and obviously people who were signing up, they didn't read it, and there were thousands of people who sold their soul to GameStation.
God knows I have never read the terms that I've agreed to. When I click that button that says, I have read and agreed to these terms, you call that the biggest lie on the web.
Yeah. Somebody else came up with that, so we borrowed that. But I think it is the biggest lie on the web because we all do it and it's never true.
Now, what you have done is create a shortcut for people like me who sign on to things and just kind of cross our fingers and hope we haven't sold our soul. How does it work?
What our website does is it has a browser extension. When you install it, when you're signing up for a website, you see a rating from class A, which is very good, to class E, which is very bad. Just like restaurant reviews, we try to see which ones are the worst ones and which ones are actually taking the effort to make good and fair terms of service.
And who's the we? I mean, you don't have a hired staff. It's a community, right?
So there's the three of us who started this and who are curating the discussion into the data points on the website. But it's an open forum, so anybody can join. There's about 400 or 500 people now on the mailing list. And you can just ask questions, say, here's this paragraph, I think that's bad, or I think this service has that, and I think that's good. All the mailing list threads then turn into this knowledge base, which then the browser extension bases its information on. So the three of us run the basis for the website, but the real discussion and the rating takes place in like a community of about 500 people on the mailing list.
What did they consider the most onerous clauses of the terms of service that they want to call users' attention to?
A lot of services get a license on your data as soon as you upload it. For instance, whenever you publish something on Facebook, they get a copyright license on your photos and on the things you write. In New York, there was somebody who took a photo of the airplane landing on the Hudson River and tweeted that. And to tweet it, they used the tool TwitPic. TwitPic then got the right to sell that photo to the media. So the copyright license is one important issue. And tracking is also important, where websites track your click behavior and make a profile about you, about which advertisements to show you. And also, this profile can often be sold on to third companies who then combine it with profiles from other websites. Those are the two main points, I think.
And then there's a third issue, and that is that some of these contracts prohibit the user from ever suing. Is that common?
I've seen it at least two or three times now, and I had never imagined that that could even be legal. And apparently in the EU, it's probably not legal, but I heard that in the US it is. To me, it sounds very strange that you sign a contract where one of the parties says, I promise not to sue you. That just sounds like a very imbalanced thing to put in any contract.
Do I understand that you're not necessarily trying to dissuade people from downloading any given app or service? It's more by way of informed choice.
Yeah. A lot of countries have like an organics label, or for instance, fair trade coffee, or sometimes washing machines have like an eco label. That way you can make a more informed choice, and you might still buy the cheaper ones, but at least as a consumer, you have a better picture of what you're buying into and what you're getting.
Yeah, so I got one more question for you then. When I download your browser extension, what do I have to agree to?
These browser extensions, they're not services. They're just the software, so you don't have to agree to anything.
And my soul intact?
Your soul intact, yeah.
Michiel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michiel de Jong, along with Hugo Roy and Jan-Christophe Burkhardt, are the team of hackers behind TOSDR.org.
So you're writing an email or texting a friend and you want to make a sarcastic joke, but you're worried that your friend won't get it. So maybe you turn to an emoticon, those faces made of punctuation marks artfully arranged to express a wink or a smile. These days, you can find faces online evincing everything from ecstasy to moral panic. But it all began 30 years ago with computer science professor Scott Fahlman. This was before the internet, back in the days of the ARPANET, when only a couple of dozen insular university departments and research institutions linked to one another. One day, Fahlman's colleagues were on the computer discussing a theoretical problem involving an elevator, and he learned to beware of nerds making jokes.
What would happen if you were in one of our elevators and somebody cut the cable and you went into free fall? If there was a candle burning, would it go out? What would happen if you had some birds flying around? Would they become all disoriented and start flying upside down in every other way? What would happen if there was a ball of mercury on the floor of the elevator? One theory was it would sort of slowly rise up off the floor. And then somebody just humorously said, well, sorry to report, but we shouldn't use the elevator in the computer science building due to some recent physics experiments. It's got some flame damage, dead birds, and some mercury contamination. And one of our administrators jumped up and said, you have to be very careful because if somebody just saw that one post, they'd think it was a serious safety warning. So we said, oh boy, you know, as long as this guy's around, we're going to have to mark everything that's not meant to be serious.
And so you and your colleagues went through a series of suggestions. One of them was putting an asterisk in the subject field. Someone else said, well, how about an asterisk for good jokes, percentage for bad jokes? And then someone else said that, no, maybe it should be an ampersand because that's the funniest figure on the keyboard.
Yes, he thought it resembled a jolly fat man laughing or something. I don't quite see that. But I was thinking, gee, we ought to be able to do better. So what can we do? And I'm looking at the keyboard, and the most obvious thing you need is eyes. So I looked at the percentage sign for a while, and maybe. My eyes landed on the colon character, and gee, that looks like eyes, but only if you turn your head sideways. But if you do that, you can make a pretty nice little face. You can make a smiley one or a frowny one. So I posted it into this message group, and I thought it would amuse three or four of my friends, and that would be the end of it.
Didn't your friends say, Scott, you're a genius, smiley face?
No, but I did notice over the next few days that people were starting to use this in their own mail to Carnegie Mellon. And then a couple of weeks later, I heard it had reached the West Coast, and it pretty quickly spread through all the research places that were on the internet, but there were only like 20 of them, and then that was the edge of the world. The interesting thing is that more and more universities, more and more research labs and companies started joining the ARPANET. They hooked up with research networks in the UK and continental Europe and Japan that already existed. And as soon as there was a connection, some email would go across the connection, and some of that email had the smiley faces in it. And then it wasn't until the early to mid-1990s people could suddenly have a computer in their living room that's connected to the internet. And they saw this crazy smiley face thing, and some of them thought it was cute, and it started spreading through there.
Now, Scott, judging from the sound of your voice, you don't seem to be the kind of person who wears your emotions on your sleeves.
Well, I think that's probably a fair assessment, actually.
Do you ever wish that you had emoticons to use in real life?
You know, I've heard an interesting story that autistic kids, their big problem is being able to relate to other people. And it turns out that a lot of those kids communicating to one another, even if they're in the same room, like using email and text messaging, because it's a little bit removed, it's a little bit less personal and confrontational. And they really love the emoticons because, I mean, here's this thing that people have criticized as taking a real human emotion and trivializing it. But that's kind of what they've been craving.
Why don't you like the word emoticon?
I've always called mine smiley faces and frowny faces. I don't claim that I invented the emoticon because people mean different things by that, and that always starts a fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it only these sort of sideways things that look like a face? Well, there was something a little earlier that was a parenthesis and an equal sign that in some very small communities meant tongue-in-cheek. Some people have said, well, you know, I used to send those things in letters I sent to my uncle back in the 1950s.
I so don't believe them.
Well, so far I haven't seen any examples, but on the other hand, I don't really doubt that necessarily. Really, if you want to think about it, maybe the earliest emoticon in English was the exclamation mark.
If I'm typing an email today, and I try to create the smiley face using the punctuations that you came up with,
yeah,
a lot of programs will automatically change that series of punctuation into that yellow, round, smiley face thing.
Right. I don't like those. I think, A, they're mostly ugly, and B, I think it kind of spoils the sort of creativity of trying to come up with some way of saying something interesting with just a few characters. Really, these days, if I want to send you a smiling face, I'll just use my camera on the computer and, and send you a picture of me smiling.
But do you just use the smiley face, or have you yourself ranged into the tongue hanging out and the sly wink and so on?
The ones I use are the smile and the frown, always with the minus sign included for the nose. I think the other ones look like frogs.
I agree.
I also like the semicolon winky one. I wish I had invented that. I don't know who did.
Scott, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Scott Fahlman is a professor of computer science at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
I'm Gooby.
I'm Zuzi.
And I'm Toofy. We're the Oogie Loves.
Everybody get on your feet.
It's time to bounce.
Producer Ken Weisselman, the marketing guru behind the explosive American success of the Teletubbies and Thomas the Tank Engine, had a vision, a movie for toddlers that encouraged the audience to sing, dance, and interact with the on-screen action. The result was The Oogie Loves in the Big Balloon Adventure, a self-distributed affair that premiered late last month on more than 2,000 screens and featured celebrities like Cary Elwes, Toni Braxton, Christopher Lloyd, and Chaz Palminteri. It was historic in that the Oogie Loves had the worst opening weekend box office in history, earning less than $500,000 over 3 days, or just $206 per screen. We got hold of Entertainment Weekly's Grady Smith, fresh from seeing the Oogie Loves in the theater. Honestly, he sounded a little dazed.
It is so many levels higher on the demented scale than I could have imagined. There is this pillow that only speaks in his own pillow dialect. There are magical balloons. There is a vacuum cleaner named J. Edgar. It is so colorful, and the songs are so weird, and you are forced to say, Goofy Toofy, pick up your pants, a myriad of times. I just wasn't even expecting something that weird.
It's kind of like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory meets Alice in Wonderland meets Rocky Horror Picture Show.
It's like all those mixed with Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
It only grossed $448,131. They spent something like $40 million on this film. How much of that was for advertising?
Well, they spent $20 million to make the film and then a reported $40 million just to promote it. So that $40 million figure is all marketing.
Now, I'm the parent of former toddlers, and I certainly understand the dynamics of a big toddler-targeted film. The kids somehow know about it through the ether, and somehow you wind up in a line with a bunch of other toddlers to see the opening weekend. Why did that phenomenon not take place with Oogie Loves?
I think the demographic of children seeing a movie like Brave, which made over $230 million this summer, is a couple years older than the type of crowd that Ken Weisselman intended on coming to see the Oogie Loves. He really wanted this to be an experience for young children. He thinks other kids' fare, like Kung Fu Panda, is too violent and too many pop references. So he wanted this to be an interactive experience where toddlers could jump up and down and goof off in the theater, but it clearly didn't work out the way he was intending it to. In 1999, another similar film called Elmo and Grouchland, it only made $11 million total, and it cost $26 million. It was another similar flop, and another example of the fact that maybe toddler entertainment is best left for television or direct-to-DVD or video titles.
I saw some of the clips from the film in one of your blog posts, and I have to say that although the production values are simply pitiful, there was something kind of endearing about watching these celebrities just completely surrender dignity just to be cute in a three-year-old way. I kind of liked it.
I mean, there's something to be said for that. I think the film cost $20 million, and like you said, the production values, they aren't that impressive, so that money had to go somewhere, and I'm guessing these celebrities were paid very well for these appearances, so they have good reason to be gung-ho into their characters. The tolerability of their performances varies. I think Toni Braxton is actually sort of funny. I think Cary Elwes is sort of unbearable. He plays a character named Bobby Wobbly, who literally can't stop wobbling and speaks in a yodel almost and blows bubbles out of his mouth.
Wobble to the left, wobble to the right, wobble bobble all around and bounce with all your might.
About 5 minutes of him on screen gets pretty grating after a while, but I see what you're saying. It is sort of funny to see them be shameless a little bit and not take themselves so seriously that they wouldn't make a movie like this.
Now, the film in and of itself is pretty bizarre, but not as bizarre as what Ken Weisselman told one of your competitors at therap.com. He said that having terrible box office was all part of his master plan. A master plan to turn this not merely into a single one-off film, but a franchise of what?
He says there are plans to make two more movies shot back-to-back in October. And he told us that he had no intention of making money with this movie. I mean, he did say that he's not going to lie and say that these were good numbers and that they were disappointed with them. But by all accounts, it looks like he's planning on moving forward. And according to Ken, the investors are still on board and they're still excited to see where the Oogie Loves go.
When Weisselman talks about how the opening weekend is not going to disrupt his long-term plans, is it possible that he's counting on the Oogie Loves' instant entry into Hollywood lore for having failed so gigantically that that will somehow propel subsequent projects into the public eye?
I think he really is looking at the big picture. I don't know that he's looking at it totally as a joke just yet. He's really interested in creating a culture of an interactive theater-going experience, which doesn't exist. You're not trained to get up out of your seat when you're sitting in a dark room and dance around. I think, though, there may be the sense that because this bombed so badly, it instantly gains this cult status, whether it's for families or for drug users in various states that want to laugh along with this film.
Grady, thank you very much.
Absolutely, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Grady Smith writes for Entertainment Weekly and EW.com. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson, with more help from Lita Martinez and Ariel Stuhlberg. And it was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Cambra Moniz Edwards.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts and read our fabulous blog at onthemedia.org. You can also find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.